Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome to Gigabit Nation. We are here this week, as in every week, helping public, private, and nonprofit organizations get broadband into every place it needs to be. This week has been really an interesting week for us on the show. We had a gentleman on Monday, Kyle Hollifield, who gave us excellent tips on marketing broadband networks and broadband programs. Yesterday we had the co-founder of Intelligent Communities Forum, who gave us a lot of good insights, sort of a starting point on how do you drive innovation with broadband. And today, because I am still here at the ICF conference, we're going to be talking to mayors from five different cities and getting different views and viewpoints on this whole thing called broadband innovation. So buckle up. We're here for 3 hours. This is going to be quite the show. And my leadoff batter, because they do have baseball up in Canada, is Mayor Mel Norton, who is from St. John, New Brunswick, up in Canada. So first, welcome to the show, and it's great to have you on.
Thank you, Craig, so much. It's a pleasure to get invited to do this, and thank you for taking the time to put together this lineup of mayors from across the world, really.
No worries. I mean, I have to thank ICF for the lineup. Show up and, you know, tap in and say, who wants to be a star? So let's jump right into it. You know, I read some of the overview that you guys submitted to ICF to become one of the top seven communities. And one of the things that caught my mind, it seems like one of your innovations, if you will, is using the technology to maximize the talent of your local folks. I want to talk about that, especially the call we had right before we went on air.
The interesting thing, and maybe just for your listeners who aren't familiar with the location of our city, St. John is a tiny city by most standards, on the sort of the eastern edge of North America. For your American listeners, if they think of where the great state of Maine is, and they go north and go a little further east, they'll find our province. Our city is sort of tucked along the coast there. And one of the realities of being in that part of the world is we're relatively isolated from the rest of the world. It's a small, isolated place, which has actually created a lot of benefits. In this way, people have been forced to innovate and connect. And one of the neat things that's happened really over the last 20 years or so is that our telecommunications company, the local company, became a leading innovator in putting fiber into the ground really early on. Two fiber optic networks run underneath our streets, and it's the most fiber intense place in the province and one of the most intense places in the country. And so that's given us an enormous amount of bandwidth. That one of the projects that we're continuing to work on is partnering with a sister city, UK, with Dublin, Belfast. And the neat thing about being able to partner with a place like Belfast is they've some of the same transformations that we've had to go through in St. John, going from an industrial community, a community based on building and primary industries, to a community that really has to bring itself, come into a new way of business, and business based on information and business based on innovation and an economy based on the knowledge and the brains of people, not the minerals in the ground or the timber in the forest.
That's interesting, because yes, obviously here in the U.S. and in many countries, really, we have lots of isolated communities, and this issue of will they be part of the 21st century is a key one. And the gentleman we spoke with right at the beginning, he seems like he has this application that links communities around the world. I mean, basically wherever you can get an internet tie-in. And why don't you describe that project a little more?
Yeah, one of the great things, and for people who are in places that like our community, really now, like no other time in the past, there's no such thing as nowhere. You never have to be in the middle of nowhere again, and that's very important for a community like ours to be able to link together with literally places around the world, which means that in real time we can connect, we can share ideas, we can innovate, and we all know that innovation really is it's a product not just of one person sitting in a room, but really it has to involve connections with people, and those connections can be in a number of ways. They can be on the streets of a city, they can be in an office setting, or they can be virtual connections, and just having that ability to link virtually in real time over some of the fastest networks anywhere in our country provides an advantage that we're just really beginning to see the benefits of.
Mm-hmm. Now, are you finding that, as Chris alluded to earlier, that individuals can now do more as a result of having this connectivity? I mean, it's not strictly a business thing per se, but it is the individual wanting to be able to reach out and become part of a bigger community or what have you.
Well, that's right. The fellow I was talking to, the person I was talking to, Chris Boudreau, he's the CEO of a company called Clinic Server, and they provide clinic management software. The majority of their clients are overseas. All of their connection software and connectivity is in Canada, and many of their clients are on the other side of the globe. So that creates the ability to not just have those connections locally, but to have those connections virtually anywhere in the world with the kind of infrastructure that you can have,
mm-hmm.
And that's built into literally the granite streets of St. John.
That makes sense. Now, in terms of practical benefits, what are we talking here? Because I think there's a segment of people, especially folks who get sort of in the anti broadband mode, who feel like, well, this is just an entertainment device. But what are you seeing in a general sense now that people are becoming more connected?
Well, in our city, one of the neat things that we're seeing, and this isn't just a phenomenon in St. John or in New Brunswick or in Canada, but you're seeing this all over the place. Those cities that create the kind of connectivity that you can have with broadband, and the kind of connectivity that we have in our community, suddenly that allows innovation, not just from an office, but from home. It allows people all over the world to literally connect on projects. Just a minute ago, we were listening to folks talk about really collaborating within parameters on the kinds of developments that you would never have had an opportunity to do in one little community, but by having the ability to connect, you can then share ideas, you can share innovation from community to community, from country to country, and that allows a degree of innovation and development that just was never possible before.
Mm-hmm.
And on a practical basis, that means creating jobs. It means creating places in our own community, for example, that you don't necessarily have to show up at an office every day to have incredibly fulfilling, incredibly creative work product. You can do it from the comfort of your living room or from the library, and it also enables the companies that are creating those innovations to save money and put it into things like research and development. You put it into the innovation versus putting it into having commercial floor space in some office building. It allows people to work in a much different way, a much more mobile way, and a much more creative and interactive way than was ever possible.
Mm-hmm. Do you see a greater level of creativity as one of the byproducts of this? It's sort of like you wake up one day and realize, well, now that I can send the video across the world, now that I can manage four or five projects or whatever, is there a greater level of just creative ideas that seem to pop up?
No, I mean, and I think that any community that doesn't see that opportunity is at risk of falling behind. The development, and one person described it as, right now the that is kind of like we're in the 20s compared to what it will be in the years to come. The rate at which the internet and connectivity is going to impact our lives is going to be tremendous, and it's sort of pulling back that curtain and realizing where we're going with being connected. It really is going to be critical to the success of any community to have an educated workforce, to have a workforce that understands the importance of connection, and then that connection leading to creative outcomes and the collaboration that you can only have by sharing ideas. There's just no way for one person or one company to have all the necessary creative capital and creative ideas that lead to the truly innovative we're going to need to do as our world moves forward.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the questions or maybe challenges is you've got a small town that's been fairly isolated from a lot of technology. How do you come in one day and say, well, we're going to bring in this network and we're going to maximize it so that it improves our community? How do you get people on board with that?
The neat things I think that I've observed anyway is that very early on there was adoption and focus on making sure the community was connected, and that came from some of the leaders of our telecommunications companies, and many of those people have gone out and become sort of the serial entrepreneurs of our community. They've begun being the mentors and the leadership of the next wave of innovation. That community desire to focus around being connected, that was fortunately in our community early on. And I what I mentioned a little earlier on, Craig,
mm-hmm.
in that just one of the natural advantages of being somewhat isolated from the rest of the world is there's already a desire to work together, to band together, to take care of each other, as it were, and then to focus on a common goal, and that happened in our community very early on. I think maybe we lost our way a little bit in focusing too hard on some of the primary industries, you know, even as recently as the late 80s and early 90s, and really when those started to crumble away, our historic shipbuilding tradition, when those things left, it was really only then that people go, right, we have to go back to what we already started. So it's key to go back to those things. It's key to recognize that we can't repeat the mistakes of the past. We can't focus on those primary industries. We've got to very much focus on the path forward, and that path forward is focused around innovation with collaboration.
Mm-hmm. What are maybe a couple of more ideas? You have the gentleman who's working on an app that will allow communities across the world to collaborate. Do you have a couple of other good examples of hometown creativity bubbling up there?
Yeah, there's some neat stuff. Let me share one that we were talking about earlier today too, and it's a model called intelligence-led policing. And intelligence-led policing is basically a system in which police officers and citizens can report in to a central system, issues of community concern, so crime issues, if there's a break and enter, or if there's an assault, or if there's some issue going on in the community, all of that data comes in on a daily basis into a central hub. And what that enables the police force to do is then look at the data and understand where in the community the hot spots where trouble are. And then instead of deploying police resources sort of in a random area or throughout the city, those police resources are put into strategic locations where they see those hot spots occur. The outcome of that, the real tangible product of that, has been decreasing crime statistics on virtually every measurable statistic, whether it's assaults or break and enters or more serious crime. The crime statistics are going down, and the benefit of that is people feel safer when crime statistics are going down, and when crime is targeted, people feel safer in the communities, they're more willing to live in those communities, and they're more willing to invest in those communities. And that's all based on just a simple innovative idea to create essentially a network solution to having crime dealt with on a daily basis, having real-time information about what was happening in the community be addressed.
Mm-hmm. It's question that kind of pops into my mind. Once a public safety group puts an application like this into play, does some of the crime reduction benefit from just the bad guys knowing that this exists?
You know, there's probably some truth in that. Guys, you know, to a certain degree, won't give them too much credit, but to a certain degree, they're going to be wise to what's going on. But what I really like about it, and this probably comes more from my role as a mayor, is that it means that we can be more efficient in how we're deploying resources, putting patrol cars out and having boots on the ground is a very expensive solution. If those boots on the ground can be minimized and targeted to specific areas and issues, well, that does a couple things. It reduces the risk of officers getting hurt, and we know where the stuff is happening, so we can reduce things like overtime, and all of those things are good for taxpayers. There's a whole bunch of wins there.
Mm-hmm. Now, shift for a little bit. Let's talk about the role of the mayor and elected officials in general. I just wrote a report where I talked about the need for a champion. You know, there needs to be some one person who's out there pushing the ball forward. Sometimes that can be the mayor or one of the senior elected officials. A lot of times in a lot of communities, it's some citizen who has just taken the reins and moved with it. What do you see as the role of the mayor? Should every mayor be the champion? Should the elected officials, I don't know fully on how your local government is structured, but have usually a number of elected representatives, you know, how much of this responsibility of moving the ball forward falls on their shoulders or should fall on their shoulders?
That's a great question. And you know, the reality of many municipal governments is mayor, and then my role is no different. I work in a weak mayor system, so we have a city manager who is really the ultimate administrator of the city, has really the care and control of the city, and the mayor and council are really the political leadership of the city. But that said, there is, in my mind, little doubt unless mayors and councils are supportive of moving forward with these kinds of ideas and supportive of making sure that the communities are looking forward to where we're going, then why would anyone else in the community, or why should anyone else in the community think to look in that direction? That said, it is clear that no political leadership, myself or anyone else included, can do the kinds of heavy lifting and create the kind of innovation that need to be done to move our communities forward. We need to be very, very open and very, very willing to partner with the people that understand and can actually get the stuff done. And I think of our own community, a guy by the name of Jerry Pond, who came out of MBTEL and is one of these serial entrepreneurs and angel investors, and a person who, as a mayor, I want to support and be behind 100%. I have to set the tone for that, and I would hope that my council would set the tone for that as well.
Always good, always good.
But you need those people to oftentimes actually get the hard work done, because you as a mayor, your role is somewhat different. You have to show leadership on it, but you need to rely really on the community to get things done. And I know that it may sound like you're shifting where the responsibility goes, but the community and the people of the community are responsible for where it comes.
Mm-hmm. Yesterday, Robert Bell, our guest, he talked about some of the steps you take to foster innovation. Because innovation is kind of a nebulous term. I mean, it's hard to really define. You know it when you see it. But as an organization that's putting money into building a network for which the expectation is that there's going to be some great innovation, whatever it may be, coming from that, how does, you know, the elected leadership both set and manage the expectation for, you know, what kinds of stuff is going to come out?
Well, and that's a good question, because it raises the issue that many communities face, and the question, you know, that would get posed, I'm sure, to me by some constituents would be, well, why should we be investing in, for example, broadband access or Wi-Fi points when we've got potholes in the road that need filling? We should take care of those more basic things first before we start putting in more access points. And really, I think that comes down to begin to communicate, communicate to the public, and communicate through both the, you know, whether it's at the council table or whether it's out in the community, that path forward. And the path forward is what we're talking about really today, which is the future of how communities are going to be connected. If we're not connected and we're not innovating, well, we can forget about having the potholes filled. We won't have people living on the streets to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
We need to always be focused a few yards out on the horizon. That's where our focus has to be. Do we have to, you know, make sure that we provide quality of life? For sure. Can we, in that process of providing quality of life, reduce investment in or turn our attention away from the horizon? Do that, we risk going the way of the dodo bird.
Mm. Now, do you see specific challenges that can get in the way of either the march to get the network in place or trying to create that innovative environment?
Probably the and I don't think our community is any different from other places in this way. It's sometimes finding the dollars to make sure that happens, and making sure that we find the economic resources to create the networks and create the connectivity that's needed, and finding the business model that allows it to happen. We heard a story today from a California community, Riverside. They've partnered with an e-waste firm to allow for free Wi-Fi access across their community, and that it's finding those innovative ways that you can work both with the public assets you've got and also the private assets. In our community, we've got a ton of fiber in the ground. A lot of it is unused. A lot of the is unused. Finding ways to partner with the companies that have put that in the ground and use that for the benefits of the community. Well, that's our challenge, to make sure that we're continuing to push those relationships and push to find the opportunities.
Mm-hmm. And Riverside, by the way, will be a guest later on today's show, and I have actually written about them a number of times in terms of how they created a number of partnerships that are all interwoven that lead to broadband adoption. And in this particular case, relationship with the e-waste company allows them to collect and sell everybody's discarded technology, which raises money, but they also get computers from the e-waste company that they then refurbish and give out as part of a broadband adoption program, where they provide training, and then at the end of the training, here is your computer. And they've done that for like 5,000 families over just a couple of years. And so it's a and I think, you know, when I at the lead part of the show, you know, I talked about, you know, using the technology to maximize the talents of your local people. And I think that represents, you know, it's like, well, what do we have as a community?
Right.
Right. Because, I mean, it's a small community. It's not necessarily a barren community. You've got all kinds of brain power floating around there. I mean, that's what I was my takeaway from reading your ICF application.
Absolutely. It's one of the neat things about seeing where a community is going, and it's a community that with even just the physical structure of it, creates a hub of innovation. I think of our downtown core, and it's a fairly densely populated area for the province. And within these old historic buildings, most of which were built in the 1880s and 1890s, are a whole host of ICT firms that are springing up and innovating, and they rub shoulders not only on the historic streets, but they rub shoulders virtually, whether it's over connecting through the internet, connecting through social media, and then in real life, just seeing each other at the coffee shop.
Mm-hmm. So, do a little bit of crystal ball gazing here in the last couple of minutes that we have. What kinds of applications do you see see coming? Oh, by the way, what's your population?
So we're really a small town by most standards. It's 70,000 in the city proper and about 140,000 in the census metropolitan area. So it's a tiny town by certainly big city U.S. standards.
Well, that very well may be, but we have some communities of 4,000 and 5,000 people and even less. So when you said a tiny town, I was thinking like, okay, well, maybe they have a couple of hundred, you know, and they're hanging on to the coastline there. But I mean, yeah, that's a fairly good size. I think we would call that a mid-size class 3, I think, or class 4 is at that population.
You're making me feel a lot better, Craig.
There you go, Mr. Mayor. You got it going on there. But seriously, what kinds of things do you see in the future?
Yeah, I mean the big opportunities that we have in St. John. One of them is in our healthcare sector. Recently, we had a medical school locate to our university campus, co-locate next to the university and the hospital, and they're all on the same footprint of land. And a lot of the education is done by virtual connection to a school in Nova Scotia, a neighboring province. So the medical school in St. John is linked virtually with classrooms in Nova Scotia. That kind of opportunity to have high-level learning is one of the huge opportunities. I can see mm-hmm. that virtual connection, that ability to have really high-level teleconferencing, the ability to virtually talk with professors hundreds of kilometers away, that kind of innovation is there. The other kinds of innovations I see are ones coming from a lot of the startup companies. And we talked about this clinic server, these clinic server folks and Chris Boudreau, and what they're doing in providing clinic management software, and then looking at how to adopt that not only for the clinical, so for physiotherapists, but also what other professional services can they then begin to work with to adapt their software to you? So I see that as another opportunity. Those are a couple of ones that spring to mind on the bat.
Now, this is a somewhat of a philosophical question, and it takes place in economic development professional circle, which is in at least in the U.S., a lot of the publicity about some of our community networks were the big companies that they would bring in. You know, like, for example, I think it was in Lafayette, Louisiana, and they put in a network, and a call center comes in with 500 jobs. And in another place, it could be 1,000 jobs. So basically, it was this whole idea that you build this broadband network, and you bring in large, innovative companies. Well, the flip side of that is the philosophy that says, well, your first effort and maybe your primary effort is making the current companies that already exist both more competitive and possibly more innovative. Do you have any feelings one way or the other in terms of, you know, either do you do one or the other? Do you do both in tandem, or do you have some sort of emphasis on one and then the other?
One of the things I think is important is it's important for our population and our people to feel like they have a future in a small community like St. John, a place that they can actually long-term be and innovate. In that way, I really like the idea of supporting the local, supporting what's growing up there. And but what I also like the idea seeing the successes that come out of that. Recently, we had a company called Radian 6, which is a product of from John, purchased by one of the largest companies in the world. Mm-hmm. And it's the opportunity to see those companies succeed. I think really there's a balance between the two. You have to support the local. That's where the innovation comes. Do we want, and does our community want to see some of the large companies come and locate and support the kind of innovative thinkers that we've got? For sure. Would I love to see a satellite Google campus set up in St. John? You bet. That's the kind of thing. Are they going to come without smart people already being there and smart people already creating great ideas? I don't think so. So I think we have to, it's the chicken and the egg. I think we've got to make sure our people are launching the products and the innovations that will attract the folks that are in those big centers in Silicon Valley and beyond.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. There was a community, I don't know, maybe 30, 40,000 people. And I think that what you just touched on, this idea of having created a pool of talent, a pool of, you know, smart people and so forth, to then be part of the draw. So that you're not just drawing people based on the physical infrastructure, but you're drawing them based on the talents that you have.
Yeah, that's, right? I mean, it is so talent-driven. I mean, one of the key themes that we've heard over and over again at this ICF conference, it's really about, in many ways, about education and higher education and then allowing people to innovate beyond that. You've got to have the people, and you've got to be investing in the people and have the smarts and the brains there. That's what really drives the economy and will drive the economy of the future.
Mm-hmm. That'll be interesting to see how this all plays out. One of the have you done much in the area of getting property owners to embed fiber technology into their facilities?
One of the neat innovations that's happened, and I'd say St. John is the first community in Canada to have this. I mentioned earlier about NBTEL, and NBTEL, for the listeners that may not know, they were the originators of things like voicemail.
Mm-hmm.
So the first company to do that, and really some of the things, the apps that you see now, are really begun with that company. They have connected every community in our city. Every home in our city and every business in our city has the opportunity to be connected to a fiber optic network. There's fiber op on every street in our community, so you can be connected to the fastest internet connections possible, and it's integrated not only into the internet connections, but also there's the ability to link it into things like smart television systems.
Mm-hmm.
So that your television then becomes really part of your an extension of whether it's your email or whether it's your social media experience or whether it's your ability to examine different corners of the earth just by searching the web. All of that's available and in the highest speeds possible because of that connection.
So from the conference so far, what things have you seen that really excite you as a mayor looking at other people's innovations?
I guess the one thing that I really have enjoyed is the ideas that have come from all corners. The number of ideas and the quantity of ideas are incredible, and some of those ideas include simple things like just partnering with other businesses in the community. Some of them include really broad-based community consultation processes or huge reinvestments. I love the idea from Riverside, the Riverside Renaissance, where they invested hugely. In 5 years, they invested in 30 years worth of infrastructure. And in St. John, we've started a bit of a theme called Renaissance City. And it's that same thing of taking what we know is a really good place and reinvesting in it and looking to the future. And this is one of the key ways to understand what that future looks like.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that game applications are going to be a driver of innovation? And I bring this up because Robert made the point yesterday about games, because a lot of games are built on simulations. So you take that basic same ability to simulate a certain situation and figure, well, where can I apply this to other industries? And then we had the presentation from, what was it, Finland, where they're doing all this entertainment stuff, where they're just like creating around music and video and stuff to happen like instantly.
And I couldn't agree more, Craig. I mean, it absolutely is. It's another spoke in the wheel of innovation, having the ability to take not only just or whether it's internet connections, but also having game application and really integrating the web into everyday experience. You think of some of the neat things we've talked about and seen today, and really it's integrating that experience into every aspect of life.
Excellent. Well, I'm going to let you get back to the conference. This has been a really great interview. It's been good to look at another city, another country, to get some different perspective. And Mel, I want to thank you for being a guest.
Pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Take care.
I see another Canadian connection is on the way.
This is true. Canada is well represented here today. And that leads us into our next guest, who is the mayor of Stratford, Ontario, Canada. And Dan Matheson, his honor, is here. And we actually met for a little bit last year. And so welcome. Welcome to the show.
Well, thanks so much, Craig, for having me on. It's an exciting time to be here in New York at Pauley Institute and, of course, at the ICF Awards Ceremony and Symposium.
So I'm going to start a little offbeat because I think last year, I think one of the more interesting things I found out was that Justin Bieber, I know you probably get it all the time, but he is the child of Stratford who is now, you know, hopefully you're like getting some hometown taxes from that man because
well, he's a great Stratford success story. Justin, at age 12, of course, and the story is legendary, had started busking out front of the Avon Theater, one of our many theaters in the community, and his mother had taped one of his performances, put it on YouTube. It went viral, ended up with some radio executives, Scooter Braun, and the rest, they say, is history. Now he's a top grossing artist at about $53 million last year, turning 17 years of age. He's a great, great kid.
And he references Stratford in every concert, right?
Quite a bit, actually. And last year, the funny story was he tweeted while we were here, and he crashed the ICF website.
Holy Moses.
So, you know, we promised we wouldn't do that this year.
All right. Well, we won't get a train of Justin tweets rolling here. But let's talk about where you guys are. So you were here last year. You were one of the top seven cities then, and you're back again. So has anything changed, been added on? When it comes to broadband, what's going on in Stratford?
Well, Stratford is uniquely positioned. We have a 70-kilometer fiber optic loop covering the whole city, and then overlaying that is a 300 access point Motorola 802.11n mesh network. So we have ubiquitous coverage over the whole city for Wi-Fi. This year's theme at the ICF is, of course, platforms of innovation. We've developed a strategy around using our fiber assets and our Wi-Fi to become a living lab. Mm-hmm. And what we've done is we've put a call out to major corporations around the world to come to Stratford, to use our Wi-Fi broadband network to try out new products they which are meant to either streamline government or enhance the experience for taxpayers within their community for social and economic good. And with that, we've had companies like Anycom, Leonovas TV, Toshiba, Cisco, RIM, to name some, table and get involved early on with different ideas and strategies. And what we're looking at are some of the things that they're doing. We'll be able to help them commercialize their ideas, and there'll be a net gain benefit back to our community, either in cost savings or, of course, quality of life.
So if you look at, I'm sure there's a lot going on, and we only have 30 minutes, but if you were to highlight, you know, one of your major innovations that has come from that broadband effort, what would it be?
I think the biggest achievement that we've been able to do through our broadband effort right now in the platform of innovation would probably be that we streamlined our healthcare system last year, where all the doctors in our community are on a mobile device of some sort, some tablet. Hospital tests that are done either in their office, hospital, or at different labs around the city are all wirelessly using our technology on a secure network to send the information back and forth. People now are seamlessly in the medical system in Stratford able to healthcare between labs and doctors' offices, test results. And I think it's led us to understand that in a rural community, small rural community, we're 32,000 people. We're an hour and a half southwest of Toronto and about roughly 3 hours northeast of Detroit. And it has allowed us to look in a very strategic way at how we can provide a great health care at a high quality to our residents that wouldn't be seen in a community our size normally. Mm-hmm. Therefore, we're kind of telling people you can live anywhere, you can live here, and you don't have to sacrifice some of those basic things.
And that's a good thing. And I just did a panel on telemedicine. There is a lot written about telemedicine. I mean, it's a huge universe of applications. What's the, I don't know, two of the big, like, practical outcomes that you see coming from, you know, all this innovation in broadband and telemedicine?
Well, what I'm finding is that people in the past have felt disadvantaged. Small communities have been kind of left to go on their own. But the use of broadband allows people to connect anywhere in the world and do anything they want. So in our community in 2000, we've now taken healthcare and we said, look, you can have the best healthcare that you could expect to get in any large metropolitan area. When we now go and say, okay, we have a digital media university, we can create the content which will be the next wave of digital communication technology right here in our community. When you see someone like Justin Bieber grow up in a small town and can actually, by using the availability of broadband to broadcast his ability, shows that you can do it. So now we're saying we can compete on the world stage. What we can do in Stratford changes how people look at small communities. You can live in those smaller communities, have the quality of life, the low crime rate, the, you know, the tree-lined streets and the great walk around your own community, and not have to sacrifice and say, look, if I want to be that great job that I've always thought, mm-hmm. I have to be in a big center. Mm-hmm. And that is what we're really pushing towards. So when we look at our other innovations, for example, Toshiba, they're trying out their new LED lights that are programmable on our streets. And what happens is they use roughly 80% less power than what our existing street lights do. The other thing they do is you can dim them up and down based on ambient light. So you can actually drive those savings more. They use our Wi-Fi network, so they actually take the data and send it right back to the utility company to say what they're using. They have a life cycle cost of about 20 to 25 years guaranteed. So all of a sudden you start looking at that savings. Just in the first 2 or 3 years in energy savings, we can buy those light bulbs. That's a quality of life. They're going to test it out. Our residents are going to get the net benefit over time. That's a practical application. On the other side of the house is Cisco, who's using their new telepresence machine in Stratford to allow our residents to go to any one of our city buildings, and they'll be able to use telepresence to get into the clerk's office, to get into the mayor's office. They'll be able to use this tool that where they don't have to travel downtown and actually go into that office to see somebody. They can do it through virtual concierge at any number of the city buildings, and it'll allow us to be more accessible to people and far more transparent.
Let me, I want to dip back a second, back to the telemedicine thing. And we will be talking about other applications as well.
Sure.
But I posed this question at a panel, which was, if you realize some of the benefits from telemedicine, you know, improved healthcare delivery, faster emergency response, so forth, is there an economic development impact to that? And I would imagine that as a mayor, you would have, you know, a good perspective on that.
Well, there's definitely an economic development impact. One of the things that we find when we do studies is that doctors want to locate in communities that allow them to practice medicine in the new economy. Graduates of healthcare schools and medicine schools are learning on the greatest equipment. You know, they're not coming to rural communities because, for the most part, they don't have the equipment they've trained. New doctors, well, you might have had a doctor in the past have 4,000 patients. A new doctor wants that quality of life, and they want 2,000. They want to be able to do medicine differently. They don't make house calls. They don't do a lot of things. So we're finding that that is an economic development tool. When we entice those, when you go and speak to corporations, and you say, look, I've got an abundance of health care. I can offer you an MRI, a CAT scan. We're a regional cancer center. Our doctors are all connected. We have some available. There's no waiting list in line, and our hospital has undergone a $70 million upgrade for a small rural hospital, and it's now one of the state-of-the-art with a C-star lab. So physicians can be doing an operation in Stratford and have it mentored and watched around the world by specialists who can help them through it. When you tell that to prospective employers and people that want to make foreign direct investment, they get excited because they see the possibility. They see the quality of life for their employees, and they want to actually be in communities that are leading edge.
Interesting, yes, because I interviewed some folks in small town Danville, Virginia. And that was one of the things they said, was that they linked their clinics, their doctors, and the hospital into basic state-of-the-art technology based or driven by their broadband network. And they use it as a great selling tool to relocate or expand.
Sure. That's just one of the quality of life indicators that people want. And when I think about it, you know, when we go to Japan, I can tell you we have five Japanese feeder plants to the Toyota assembly plant that's about 30 minutes from our door. The Japanese never asked me about the cost of land or the cost of taxes. What they ask me about are quality of life indicators. The thing that they're doing business on in the world today is what it's going to be like for their corporation. Are they environmentally sustainable in that community? Do they have a commitment to Kaizen, continuous improvement? Where do they think their position in the world are? What are the healthcare benefits? What's the education like? And when you actually sell your community based on those, you are far more successful going forward than in the past. Mm-hmm. The day of cheap real estate and low taxes is not where it's at anymore. It's about redundant power. It's about access to fiber. It's about quality of life. And it's about the knowledge economy.
Mm-hmm. And that makes a lot of sense. That makes a lot of sense. Now, let's talk about how big is Stratford, by the way?
32,000 people.
Okay. And you have you are pursuing a variety of applications and so forth. How easy was it to get all these various stakeholders together on the same page?
You know, ICF has been very strategic for us. We've mm-hmm. been able to articulate a vision, and we've been able to point to success stories using the ICF model. Communities from around the world. And when you do that, people then say, oh, okay, it's been validated. It has helped us unite people around a common goal. We've been able to collaborate. And we end up sharing a common vision. And when you create it in a group, a collaborative group, it's far more easy to do. And we don't have the mayor's office own it. We don't have the economic development office own it. We don't have the chamber of commerce. Everybody owns it. It's a piece of the whole community. And when you actually put it into layman's terms, whether it's my father who worked in a manufacturing setting his whole career, I have to explain to him what the knowledge economy is for his generation. And when I tell him, it's about access to fiber. We have a plant in Stratford that makes auto parts. They're linked right to the quality control center of a major automaker. When a part comes off of that line, it has a barcode, and they know whether it meets the quality standards that they're looking for mm-hmm. within micrometers. So, you know, they know right away whether it's a good piece of equipment or not because it goes through a computer network and gets scanned. The employee that puts it needs to know how to program that computer, knows how to operate it, and he knows when that part comes off whether he's sending it to a truck or sending it back as scrap. That's a knowledge worker in the future economy. We used to think of them as a menial job or a labor job. That's actually a knowledge worker.
Mm-hmm. And that is setting of the pace. And I would assume that the vision of that, I mean, as you explain this to people in terms of how these roles are shifting, helps the buy-in as well.
Oh, definitely. You know, we've been part of a group in Canada that's looked at a thing called Menial No More. The jobs by 2020, there will be no menial jobs anymore. But no matter what you do in your chosen profession, where you work, you'll have to have some knowledge of how to operate a piece of technology. And we're starting to see it now. You know, go to a restaurant, see a waiter, waitress. You know, they're handing around handheld devices. Mm-hmm. They're actually putting information right in that goes to the kitchen, automatically produces a bill. There might be a runner bringing the bill. You know, that job used to be in the past. Remember when they used to write it down and
yep.
go?
Yep.
They don't do that anymore. That's a knowledge worker in some more. They need to know how to program those things. We're finding people are adapting technology and standards to either improve efficiency, gain productivity, or drive down costs.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the drivers of what are going to make jobs menial no more.
Right. Now, does that bring up a worry then that on the one hand you have innovation that creates jobs, brings people to a higher level, economically, socially, and so forth. Is there a danger that the technology could lose jobs?
No, not really. You know, I think as jobs change, and we've seen it happen where banks – are a good example. Sometimes they farm stuff out and they try technology. They realize it's not the latest, greatest thing, mm-hmm. and they go back to a hybrid. So it's an evolution piece as it goes along the way. I think what we really have to realize, though, is we have to make sure that social inclusiveness, that no one gets left behind, that people at different socioeconomic levels all have access to the broadband network and also have access to training. And when you do that, everyone works together. And I think that is probably the biggest thing that happens. People say, oh, technology took a job away. Well, technology also has the opportunity to help you find a different job if you have access to it and you have knowledge of what it can do for you.
Mm-hmm. So there's an education process that has to happen and some refer to as retooling of the workforce, if that's the latest econ development terminology. But
yeah, definitely. And I think that's one of the things that I think will workforce much better into the future. Is that if communities, when they develop these broadband connectivity plans, also spend some time developing social inclusiveness plans.
Mm-hmm.
How are we going to reach people at different socioeconomic levels? How am I going to make sure that seniors who have lived a very productive life and career don't get left behind because they don't know what the next greatest, latest thing is?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you have to reach out and kind of for lack of a better word, to wrap your arms around everybody and find a way to make everyone part of the team.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, is the biggest challenge communities have. We all know that having, you know, a rim, an apple, or something in your science major, doing something neat and cutting edge, but you're people behind.
Mm-hmm.
That's where communities develop rifts and shifts. That's why they can't collaborate.
Mm.
That's where the vision falls apart.
Mm-hmm. So do you put programs in place? Do you bring in partners specifically for that task? How do you ensure that?
Well, an interesting thing we have going on in Stratford called AvaNova, which is our Technology Professionals Association.
Mm-hmm.
They've taken it upon themselves to start offering courses for seniors. Digital literacy.
Very cool.
Got them talking about in schools, helping low-income families.
Mm-hmm.
They're refurbing computers that they get donated from banks and other financial institutions after they're done. And what they're doing is, when they're developing these opportunities for them, they're actually using it now
mm-hmm.
to try to educate people at the other end. So they're taking their skills, and they're doing this in their own personal time
mm-hmm.
for community good and community and social gain. And
mm-hmm.
that says an awful lot about the type of citizens that communities are developing today versus what we would have maybe 10 years ago.
Right, definitely, definitely. Now, what do you see as the role of the mayor, first and foremost, but also the other elected officials? And to put it in the context, I've been writing about, you know, communities need to have a champion. Often, if you look at stories from Chattanooga and Pulaski, Tennessee, in a number of places, there was one person who just became it, wasn't appointed, wasn't elected, wasn't an elected official, but became sort of the embodiment and the driving force for broadband. Now, the mayor and elected officials can take that role, but they don't have to. But from to flip it around a little bit, what do you see as the role they should have or maybe most advisable to have?
Well, I think it's whatever your community needs. In our case, I believe my is an enabler.
Mm-hmm.
We can't be all things to all people.
Right.
I don't have buckets of money, and I can't make it all happen. But I can enable through collaboration to get corporations to spend their money on social good and broadband connectivity. I can get school officials in the system working together.
Mm-hmm.
I can help link groups together, and I can bring it all together. We need champions at different stages and different facets of this whole piece. So, for example, I have a member of council. She's a librarian at the local high school. She's taken it upon herself to take digital literacy to the next step, preserving our heritage, to
mm-hmm.
talk about how we take the artifacts of our community, digitize them, get them online, and make sure that they're accessible for future generations.
Mm-hmm.
I have officials at the school board who are doing an online high school, making sure that you can go to high school if you want in Stratford and never step foot in a classroom. You can get a high school diploma from grade 9 through and never once step in the school. You can take every course online. And that's because somebody there decided to be a champion.
Mm-hmm.
We have a president of our hospital, Andrew, who's a great visionary, who said when he was going to redevelop this hospital, I wanted to have the best primary care hospital for a community our size with leading edge technology. He and our chief of staff worked with the family health teams to make sure they were able to do it. And that's a champion in that one.
Mm-hmm.
So you know what? We have various champions in different sectors. We collaborate and we have enablers, people who do the linkages together and encourage and try to help motivate.
And do these folks just sort of come together over time? Do you do a little bit of a recruiting of these champions? Or
I think it requires cities to stay nimble. I don't think I ever, somebody said to me, where's that plan that you had on this? I couldn't go to my book study, pull out a binder and say, here it is right here. We laid it out.
Mm-hmm.
Broadly, in 1997, the city of Stratford said we had a plan for 2010 and beyond, and that was to be a community of excellence with worldwide impact.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted to have digital technology. We wanted to have an ICT sector, and we wanted to make sure that what we did was social inclusiveness.
Mm-hmm.
All those things have happened, but it wasn't one person that did it.
Right.
It's because everybody kept that plan in mind and did mm-hmm. their part to make it happen.
Mm-hmm.
And people have ways that they can involve other people and try to link them together, and they found ways to share costs and collaborate. And that's truly what a community does. It's an ongoing networking exercise. Some people think there's a light bullet. You know, they think there's that, you know, light switch. Well, we said we were into this. How come it hasn't happened? I've had some people say that to me. You know, we finished in the top seven, but I haven't factory go up, or I didn't see a new mm-hmm. bank financial center. You say, look, it's not a light switch, it's a generational change, it's a mindset and it's a philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And you need to seize the opportunity to bring people together and collaborate and and share a common vision. And that's, I think, the ICF model is going to work. 400 communities a year start out on this.
Right, right, right.
You get to 21 down to 7, you end up with one person who is your kind of mentor idol for the year.
Mm-hmm.
And those communities continue to evolve, and they have experiences to share, and communities have just got to pull it in and take it back and use it in their own way, in the best way they can.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the interesting questions I have been pursuing both yesterday and today is this question of, innovation is somewhat nebulous. We can all see it. We can all see the results of it. But it's not like saying, you know, we're going to bring 100 new jobs or we're going to bring a medical center. Is there a way to plan for innovation, or is the best you can hope for is to create an environment that is conducive to innovation?
I think you have to have a stated end goal where you get to.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have a couple of key points along the way that you're going to measure yourself against, and head out and you try to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Often when we head down those roads, I try to look at best practices from other communities. I try to take the best I can out of them, and I try to adapt them to what meets the needs and the thoughts of the people in my community.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have markers along the way that I say, okay, have I hit that guidepost? And if I didn't, why did? If I did, has it made me as successful at this point as I thought I would? Or if I'm successful in spite of not hitting that marker, maybe my plan in the first place was off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a continuous improvement piece. And I think that's one of the greatest things about this. I love sitting down and hearing the experiences of other communities.
Mm-hmm.
I've learned so much from sitting in today, hearing about what the other communities have done and how they've used assets, whether they're digital assets, community assets, social assets, to make a difference in the lives of their residents. Often we go to municipal conferences and you talk about the same thing with the same people year after year.
Right.
And the problems are the same year after year.
Mm-hmm.
Here I always find it's an evolution. Mm-hmm. It's you throw out a problem out, and before long people have solved it, and you have an opportunity to go on to the next challenge.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the future a little bit. What kinds of innovations? You've got a town of 30,000, not the smallest, but definitely not the biggest. However, there seems to be a hotbed of activity going on, lots of interest, lots of different things going. What are some of the main innovations that you think may be coming out of Stratford in a year or two?
Well, a good example would be Leonova's TV.
Mm-hmm.
They here, of course, in Stratford have a great opportunity. They've been beta testing internet TV for the last year. What they've done is they've made this internet TV an opportunity to be a communications tool where it can aggregate data from the community, allow you to display it on your traditional TV. They've allowed you to go out and get information. And they've been evolving this whole piece of technology over some time. And Leonova is a good example where they're going to take an everyday piece of someone's life and become a communications tool. You heard yesterday at the workshop, Gordy Campbell, the CEO of Leonova, saying, you know, there's a lot of computing power in a house.
Mm-hmm.
And it needs an aggregator.
Mm-hmm.
I believe Leonova's is going to prove out that technology. They're going to be an aggregator. And in 2 or 3 years, that kind of technology, whether it's them or it's another company, are going to prove that technology out. And we'll be able to proudly say Stratford's network of fiber and Wi-Fi actually played a part in that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, let me I want to come on to this before. We've got about 2-3 minutes to go. Wireless off the fiber. Once upon a time, back in 2005, when I pretty much got into this segment of the business, it was because of municipal wireless. And people painted, I don't know about it in Canada, but definitely in the U.S., people painted great canvases of visions around municipal Wi-Fi. This was going to solve problems and open opportunities and so forth and so on. Now, and it didn't. I mean, it fizzled for a number of reasons. But what I'm seeing now, both what you're describing and also Chattanooga are several places that are building aggressive wireless networks on top of the fiber. Do you think that with the introduction of fiber, maybe lower costs, a number of whatever technology issues, that the promises of municipal wireless are more obtainable now than they were in 2005?
Well, I think what's happened is we've seen smart meters.
Mm-hmm.
Come, you know, time of use meters for hydro.
Mm-hmm.
And in the past, we used to have somebody walk around each house, plug in your number, and
mm-hmm.
that's how you do it. Well, a lot of communities, and in the province of Ontario, and I know in California, they're actually going to these meters now that transmit the data.
Mm-hmm.
So you can do it three ways. You can use a 900 megahertz radio. You can use a cellular chip in every meter
mm-hmm.
and actually make it a Wi-Fi. In our case, we Wi-Fi. So we're actually using a utility need as the reason to build it and the base costs covered to do it. And now we're able to layer on top of that. We're able to actually monetize that asset and make it useful. And that's what we've done in our case. I think that's why, because people are finding why they're now needing the Wi-Fi. It's we had the vision of having Wi-Fi 5 or 6 years ago, but now we're actually finding the utility use for it, and then now we're catching up to it. The other thing I'd like to say is a lot of people say, oh, we should have free Wi-Fi. There's no such thing as free Wi-Fi. Somebody's had to pay for the pipe. Someone's had to put the access points in. It's free. It's free for utility as a use. It's actually cost in a capital sense, and I think people need to realize that. And as times come down now, we're seeing access points drop in cost, seeing maintenance of networks that are becoming far more robust and costing less to maintain, and that's what's going to make the difference in the future economy.
So, conclusion, I know there's so much we can talk about, and I may very well call you again to talk more as things by. What advice would you give to a project team that, you know, they're looking at this broadband, there's probably a lot of expectations on their shoulders, you know, from the community, and they say, you know, this broadband network is going to be a source of innovation. Now, saying that and delivering are obviously, you know, can be light years apart, attainable, but, you know, but it's a part. So if you had to give, you know, one or maybe two pieces of advice on how to get from here to there as an innovation tool, not all of a sudden, but as an innovation tool, what would your advice be?
First, find a goal that is not audacious, so small and meaningful in the life of the residents. Two, set a small or short time window to achieve. Three, make it measurable and transparent so people know what you're doing. And four, celebrate the success when it's done.
Excellent.
I think, you know, in a course, for example, for us, we said we were going to put Shiva lights in downtown. We have meters on them. We report regularly how much energy we saved and what the true cost savings are to the municipality. And people actually go down now and they see it and they go, yeah, I do see that. That does make sense. That's saving me money. How do I get some of those for my home? And that's how you do it. So you can't have these big audacious plans where people, you know, go, well, that's 2 years. I can't wait 2 years, or I can't wait to see that. You need to have something measurable and visible.
Right.
All right.
And clear. So anyway, I want to thank you, Mayor Meisen.
Matheson.
Thank you. And it's been great. I mean, I words kind of escape me here. I'm just, there's like so much going on, but I want to thank you for your time here and all of your ideas and insights. And like I said, we'll be talking again as things go.
That's great, Craig, and I really appreciate it. Now, Mayor Jason Hu from Tangchung, Taiwan, is here, and he is going to jump in here, and I'll tell you, this guy's a firecracker, got lots of ideas. You're going to need an hour, not 30 minutes.
All right. Sounds good.
Right here.
Come on, have a seat, sir.
Firecracker? Explosive?
One of those North American expressions.
I know.
How are you today, sir?
Okay. A little jet lag, but otherwise okay.
That's quite all right. Well, thank you very much for being a guest on my show, and I look forward to hearing a lot of your ideas and what's going on. Let's start with maybe just a short description of what your city is doing in the area of broadband, and then we'll dig into the question of innovation.
We are a major city in Taiwan. It's called Taichung, and Chong in Chinese means central. So we are at the very center of Taiwan. Allegedly, we're the third largest in Taiwan maybe 5 years ago, 10 years ago. Now we think we're second largest next to the capital of Taipei.
Ah, yes, okay.
In the north. And we have about 2.7 million people.
Whoa.
A lot of people. And we are twice the size of Hong Kong, and about three times bigger in terms of geography, three times bigger than Singapore. But we are both an industrial and agricultural societies. So, and we have cultural activities, and about 7 or 8 years ago, we visioned this broadband age telecommunication is to change our life.
Okay.
So we started working in this direction. Both the public and the private sectors about 8 or 9 years ago.
8 or 9 years ago, you got really moving. Okay.
It'll pay off now. Otherwise, I wouldn't be sitting here.
Very true. Very true. So now, what are some of the innovations that have come from your network over this time?
Well, originally, it started in really three aspects. First, probably in 2003, local cable TV company came to me and said that they're facing tremendous pressure from the city council asking to reduce their cable rate as they're making money. Once you make money, the local politicians, councilmen, and all that say, oh, they need votes from the people, say they're going to come out and say, reduce the rate, benefit to the people, not to the company.
Right.
You know, very anti-capitalistic, democratic. And I said to them, I said, if I'm able to persuade these council members to let you keep most of your profit, what are you going to do with it? They say, well, Mayor, what do you want us to do with it? I say, reinvest. Fiberglass, broadband, wireless, hotspots, all these things being done in other countries or in the tech or being advocated by the telecommunication company, we must start to do this. So about 8 years ago, they promised me, and I persuaded the council to let them keep the rate, and they keep invest and reinvest and reinvest. And then we talked to the central government, as we are a local government. We work on a project which is building an intelligent park, which offers cloud engineering data bank services to factories in the industrial park. So an iPark in an iPark, an intelligent park in an industrial park.
Okay.
And we actually only have about, this is 2005, we actually only have about 90-some companies in the industrial park, precision machine tours industry. But more than a year, more than 400 companies joined our network. They save money, they become more efficient, they're updated. So that's the second part, with the help of the central government and with their money too. Thirdly, the local government, my government, is working very hard to expand broadband fiberglass installment. We invest a lot of money. Now we have the longest length of service. I mean, about what, 1,700 kilometers of broadband cable. That's the longest of any city in Taiwan. So we could, we spend a lot of money too. We spend, you know, more than maybe close to $200 million over about 3-4 years. And now people are starting to rent our broadband cable, and we're getting paid, and we're moving ahead. So in these three regards, the private cable TV company, the central government in the industrial park, and the city government who does broadband cable service system.
Well, in some respects, you could say that some of the innovation was in how you got the government and the private sector to work together.
Yes. Not only that, it's that, you know, it could easily have happened in any other given city or even in Taichung that the local politicians successfully persuaded the city government, the entire council, to force the cable company to reduce their rate to please the voters. what we are seeing today may never happen, you know, from the private sector.
Right.
So that was good because I was almost 7 or 8 years mm-hmm. pioneered the vision in that direction. And we were the first in Taiwan.
Mm-hmm.
We might have been the first in many areas in the Far East or in Asia. We're fortunate.
Mm-hmm. Now, yesterday, someone from your group described a portal application that you have. Is that one of many of your innovations? Is that the first major innovative product?
That, I think, was done by our Commission of Research and Development,
mm-hmm.
which works very hard in this direction. Yet, we have many innovations in this regard. Broadly speaking, not confined to economic development
mm-hmm.
or technology only. It goes into government work like crime fighting.
Ah, yes.
You know, we are the first city, this is partly called e-government, I think.
Yes.
We're the first government in my country to have installed what they call electronic city
mm-hmm.
surveillance systems around the border of the city
mm-hmm.
and make sure that you're well in control of any situation or accidents or even crime taking place within the city,
mm-hmm.
that you'll be able to you know, control the situation and find out who did what.
Okay, so in that regard,
down crime rate
okay.
tremendously.
Uh-huh. That's actually been a theme throughout, I think, this ICF conference, been the ability of the technology to help fight crime.
Yes.
And we heard about
yes.
it last night. One of the guys here today talked about that. And are there other government services that can expand from that public safety application?
Water control, flood control, you know, and we're carefully monitoring rainfall, irrigation, all this, and the tax system, as you know. Somebody like it, somebody don't like
right.
it.
Right. That's always the case.
We work hard to provide a surveillance system that could read license tag,
mm-hmm.
you know. Drive a car passing a crossroad in my city, and your license tag is picked up. And if it's a stolen car, as you're driving, the next traffic light will report where you're going, and the police will be waiting for you.
Uh-huh.
All that kind of thing, you know,
there
which
you
I
go.
Think is very helpful.
Mm-hmm. From a planning perspective, how easy was it to once you negotiated with the private sector and the various government entities, how easy was it from that point to get other people in the community, the businesses, the hospitals, so forth, behind the broadband project?
I actually think the business sector is an easy sector.
Uh-huh.
People think it's difficult
mm-hmm.
because if you want them to cooperate, you will want them to contribute money-wise.
Mm-hmm.
If they don't see benefit for themselves, why should they be involved? But the fact we have only 92 factories in one industrial park of precision machinery, we have to come one park.
Mm-hmm.
But not the park. We have an intelligence park,
mm-hmm.
iPark. In
mm-hmm.
it, we provide cloud engineering, cloud data services, data bank services, and all that. Now, you know, about 400 companies joined us, i.e. more than 3/4 of the users of the iPark are not factories or companies in the industrial park. They're all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why should they join us? Because we've calculated for the first year, the shift efficiency increased 18%. And the, I think, profit was brought forth, amount to, I think, more than $100 million U.S. dollars. I mean, it's not much. Maybe, $150 million or something U.S. a year for all the companies. But for each company, making money is good and important. So how do I persuade them? You don't need to persuade them. You just do it.
Right.
And they'll see it quickly. And if you're not successful, why should they be with you? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm happy to see the trend. I think it's going smoothly and successfully.
That's good. Now, who, after then, the businesses are getting on board with the broadband? Is it individuals? Is it hospitals? Who's your next big category of subscribers?
The health sector, certainly, that need to be involved. We have a very successful National Health Service, probably one of the best in the world, but it's losing money. You know, it's not making money. So we have to find a way, just for local government, citywide, we have to find out where we can save more money and provide more services.
Mm-hmm.
That we haven't tried hard, because this is mainly a domain of central government,
right?
Federal government. But I think that's where we have to do. Secondly, social welfare, where I think we could be more efficient and save some money in manpower by being more, quote unquote, intelligent.
Right.
And social welfare can be done better. I think the general problem in my city is that there was a merger of the county and the city last January. I was the mayor before that.
Mm-hmm.
I was reelected for the bigger title.
Oh,
combining the county and the city.
Okay.
The county has 1.6 million people. I had only 1.1. So more people are in the county than in the city.
Mm-hmm.
It's more rural,
more rural,
agricultural.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. It's not as urban as the downtown area, the
mm-hmm.
city area. My problem is how to face this problem of disparity.
Mm.
You know, as if there's a gap, digital wise, broadband wise, whatever you call it, there's a great gap, disparity in the old city and county.
Mm-hmm.
And more people are in the county. And they may not be so well informed about this. And maybe they want the service of the government. But if you try to tell them, but we need to spend money on most of this broadband and wireless network and all that, it takes time.
Mm-hmm.
We're setting up setting up three more sort of digital training information center for offering courses for the people, even, senior people.
Mm-hmm.
But that, as I said, at this moment is my main problem. We need to spend more money and move forward. If my work, my concern, the old downtown area, it would be much easier. We move much quicker.
Mm-hmm.
But mayor cannot do only part of the city.
Right. You have to get it all.
Yeah.
I think we in the U.S. have a similar issue with faster broadband adoption in many parts of the urban areas.
Mm.
And it's slower in the rural areas.
Right. Cost more in the rural areas.
Okay. Because
yes.
It's harder to get to. Well, I think for us, it's also an issue that we just don't have the infrastructure out there.
Mm.
I mean, we don't have the networks built because there's a small number of people. But the one thing that I do feel is an issue is people's awareness.
Oh.
And you have to get past a certain amount of reluctance because people don't know. And it sounds like that's the kind of a situation you have
You're
in the county.
Exactly what I was trying to say.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a very important task. One cannot avoid. You know, you just have to do it and to do it well.
Right.
You cannot just do only the urban areas and forget about the rest. And you know, when you talk about the disparity, you're not talking about more people in the rural area.
Right.
I have more people in the rural area. They are 60% of my population,
mm-hmm.
if not 65.
Wow.
So that, you know, in a sense, more important
mm-hmm.
than the urban area. If I don't do it well, my GPA, the grade point average, will be lower.
Right.
All the statistics are not moving forward, but going backward. Because of, I am now 15 times larger than when I was before,
mm-hmm.
a year ago.
So what advice would you give to other communities? You started with breaking down barriers between the elected officials and the private service providers.
Right.
Past that and then put the technology in place. Businesses saw it, and businesses have come to the table. And then you have gone, and you talked about your other progressions. What are the two or three biggest, I don't know, things that you could advise others to consider or to actually do?
Well, I actually think when I talk to the city council members, I was doing something, I think, which was not easy. A general political rule has it that people need to vote. They will reduce rate. And I persuaded them to support my idea of not reducing rate, but let them reinvest.
Mm-hmm.
And the council member agreed. But to that, I'm very grateful.
Right.
That, I think, it not just bringing the politician and the private sector together, but to change a general popular thinking,
mm-hmm.
you know, which I think is the basis of the success, reason I'm here
mm-hmm.
today. But what would I say to other people about the future? From my experience, I think I've made the right decision.
Mm-hmm.
This one that, you know, broadband communication and all these intelligence, quote unquote, all the issues concerned are not part of humans. They're the ultimate destiny, common destiny of human beings, of all cities. You have to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you're far behind.
Right.
You know, it's not whether you do it or not. It's when, how, you know, you have it.
Mm-hmm.
That's number one. But if I am allowed to talk about the future, I'd like to say something I think many people have not thought about. I think we have to tie what we're doing at this end with the concern about our world in terms of sustainable development. I think we should think more about low carbon, sustainable development, green earth, and bring the two issues together. Yet, all these efforts bring a city more updated in terms of modern-day mobility, telecommunication, and all that is important and vital to the economic development, to the social awareness of my city, of any city.
Mm-hmm.
But when we bring these two big subjects much closer together and become almost inseparable, i.e. all these broadband wireless hotspot efforts, can we link it closer to the environmental issue?
Mm-hmm. Now, it seems that to be able to do this, somebody has to be the visionary, and then after being the visionary, they also have to be the champion. They have to go out and they have to, as my daddy would say, preach the gospel.
Yeah.
You know, to go out and really get the communities really to understand and get behind it. which I would think is a big challenge, because the average person on the street sees technology, but they don't know what technology means, you know, and maybe sometimes visions are a little too far ahead of them. I don't know. How do you deal with the, you know, the average citizen on the street? How do you get them to understand that a vision of broadband innovation is a good thing?
I think it may not be too difficult to try to make them understand broadband is a good thing, because everybody is going into iPad, computer, notebooks, mobile phones. You know, everybody's into it, the younger generation, network,
right?
You know, YouTube, everything, Yahoo. What I'm concerned more is that we seem to have two major tide of social development. One is this broadband, and the other one, like I said, is sustainable development. And we're all preaching in different arenas.
Mm-hmm.
If you're asking me how to put two together and bring them closer, I think it's important. I just say, I think broadband and all this is a policy option. It's not whether you do it or not. The ultimate common destiny of what about sustainable development? Isn't that exactly the same thing?
Right. How do you keep people growing, and how do you keep communities growing and alive for the long term?
Right. You're growing with speed and space in terms of broadband and all that. But on the other hand, you need the earth.
Right.
Otherwise, all the growth means nothing. But I was just trying to say, I see these two main sort of topics or issues or whatever still are not closely intertwined.
Right.
And that's my worry. You want to praise, you know, preach the gospel and all that. I think that's important.
That's become part of the...
That's
the,
what you're doing today.
That's what I'm doing today. That's right. Out here preaching the gospel and
that's what we should all be doing.
I think that it's a... one of the challenges is keeping everybody in the same message, because I know that when we talk about broadband, we sometimes talk about it can do all of these things. And then once you start talking about business and healthcare and economic development and so forth, then the messages start to get diluted for the person in the street, for the average person. And somewhere there's, I think, a challenge to create a message that everybody buys into. Someone's got to create the common song, if you will, or the common gospel, I guess, if you. This has been very, very helpful. Any words of advice here in our last 2 minutes?
Oh, I'll take whatever people give me. I don't give advice.
Want to be, yes, indeed. Well, this seems to be a very good venue, you know, where people are exchanging a lot of ideas, which I think is a big plus of governments, because
indeed,
governments do do share a lot, and
indeed,
that works well for us.
Yes. I have never been to the conference or the forum. First time, I've been to New York. But
Right.
And I think it's a very good thing to do. Mm-hmm. And I will try to, if not myself, but the city keeps coming back.
Mm-hmm.
I hope more and more people can see the light.
Right, exactly.
You know, and join the rank, so we could all do what we need to do.
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, people can be aware of what's so important in this area.
Right, indeed. I envision that I will be coming back to talk to you again as
thank
things
you.
Progress.
Thank you.
Oh, I want to thank you for being
here. Thank you
a
very
guest
much,
today.
Fred.
All right.
Thank
Have
you.
A good day and a great rest of the conference.
Right.
All righty.
I'm sure of that.
All right. That was a very good overview. I think, you know, I've made this point before, is that, in the U.S., so I think we can get insular in our thinking, and it really is helpful to look beyond our shores to be able to come up with ideas and cross-pollinate ideas and be able to collectively come up with solutions and innovations. Because again, as I've mentioned throughout these interviews yesterday and today, innovation is a broad topic and has many parts, and we somehow get handled on it. And often it's better that collectively to do it all on our own. So I'm going to transition now and come back a little closer to home, like quite literally. I'm from California, as many of you know, and so one of the top seven is a California city, Riverside, California. And for those who've been on the show, you know that Riverside has been both on my show and also the topic of many of my writings because of the innovative stuff that they're doing. So I am extremely happy to have the mayor, Loveridge of Riverside, as well as Steve Reniker, back again, CIO of Riverside. And gentlemen, both of you, thank you very much for being here. And let's get close to the mic and let's talk about what's going on in Riverside. So I'll start, Mr. Mayor, with you. We're here last year. You have been doing a lot of stuff in broadband for a number of years. What's big? What's happening now in terms of innovation? What's new coming out of Riverside?
Well, you know, it's one of the interesting things about broadband and technology is that every day it seems it's major. It is not a static thing. It is. It is moving very, very quickly. I mean, we've just listened to a little bit yesterday about in our K-12, one of our two school districts, and how important digital is there, and they've moved from books to using essentially iPods. And I was at an elementary school visiting last week and watched the kind of delight that these students had, and they were sort of game playing, but they were game playing for numbers or game playing for concepts, and it was interesting to see this digital thing is becoming a centerpiece now of education in Riverside. I suspect that what I saw and that after school class is being repeated throughout the district and will be repeated throughout the country.
Mm-hmm. So let me jump on with both feet the high school example, because this has intrigued me greatly. I've watched the video. You know, you guys did presented the video earlier this morning, which, by the way, kudos on a very quick adopt and perform. I was telling Steve that I was very amazed by that. I had a band director when I was at UC Berkeley, and he was always, you know, if something went wrong, adapt and perform, adapt and perform. So you guys have done that. But I think in broadband is probably a good, you know, good example as well. You guys seem to have adapted, or the school district has adapted the technology to help students perform better. And I think our audience needs to know more about that.
One of the problems is, used to see school districts, there was a discussion of here. You lived in a neighborhood, you went to a school, didn't like what was going on in the school, it's too bad you lived in the neighborhood. Now there's immense choices for parents where their kids go to school, which has put got pressure on to not simply perform, but to try to look for innovation to ways that they can be distinctive. And Riverside Unified is one which has tried to build a kind of reputation of choice out of the new technology.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk particulars, though. I mean, you guys have some interesting redefinition of learning that's happened. I mean, that's how I view it. Maybe I'm putting too grand a picture on it, but...
No, well, but one of this kind of concept, which is just interesting, is you used to go to class, and you when the class is over, you went home or you went to the next class. The idea with the digital kind of connection is that you're not limited to the period of the class. It can be after class. It can be on weekends. That is, there's invitation for the student to take much more control of their performance, that it is being less teacher based and more student based.
Mm-hmm. That is actually something that I had a conversation with several months ago with someone who said the same thing about the technology in the workforce, because in essence, it takes away the walls, for better or worse. I mean, there are some definite downsides to that, but they sort of open up how we can work with others, that you don't have to be in the office to collaborate. You can collaborate with 25 people in two different parts of the hemisphere.
Yep.
So basically, it sounds like you have taken that idea and it's now being applied in the classroom. Why be confined by the classroom wall when we can unite our kids with the universe?
That's right.
Steve, have you been directly involved in that?
I have. In fact, I graduated at Ramona High School. So I'm proud to say that, you know, Dr. Rick Miller of Riverside Unified, he's rolled out Android tablets to every student at Ramona High School. And they've had them now over a year, so they finished their first year, first all-electronic high school in California, third in the United States. And they've gotten some very interesting feedback. You know, some of the feedback they've gotten is average algebra scores compared to traditional methods of teaching, 30% higher than they were last year.
Mm-hmm.
I think the test scores for Riverside, we try to
That's actually going to be the issue now, is that with this technology, what difference does it make to the test scores in which we judge schools by? And we'll see.
I mean, it's interesting, you know.
We don't know yet.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know yet.
I think that's okay. You know, I mean, we're going on a journey, and we're not sure exactly where the end point is, but it's going to be interesting, and I think early signs are it's going to be productive.
And we're not going to go back. I think that's the other thing.
Oh, yes.
This is not the traditional form, I think, of the teacher. And part of that was, you know, the ability of parents to be able to follow what it is that their kid is up to, rather than asking, how's it going? And he's fine. And the parents have access to that record as well as obviously the kid.
Because I think that, you know, as I have read articles, you know, when people start talking about the state of education in the U.S. and so forth, often the comments, even the comments to articles in the media, on the web, when you look at the comments underneath, you see a lot of comments along the line of, if the parents aren't involved, there's problems.
Yeah.
And, I mean, is that pretty much the heart of, the in essence, this transformation, is that let's go to the issue of the parent involvement?
Well, particularly in Southern California, which is now majority Hispanic,
mm-hmm.
if you look at the schools, they're increasingly majority Hispanic. The real quest is how to involve the parents in both understanding and participating in the education. And I've been a great champion of the lighted schoolhouse, that you got to see school beyond a 9-to-3, beyond a student. It needs to be teacher, student, parent, nonprofits, and whoever else might have an interest in what goes on.
Mm-hmm. So how easy was it to get the education administration and the rank file of the teachers on board with this concept? Because if you listen to conventional wisdom, especially emanates from D.C., you know, the teacher role is somewhat sacred, and the union, you know, how they do what they do is somewhat structured.
This doesn't change teacher salaries, doesn't change teacher hours, doesn't change teacher pensions. I mean, there's some sense that for a teacher, at least looking at the contract remains the same.
Mm-hmm.
But Dr. Rick Miller, he took an interesting approach to it. He's not forcing it on the schools.
Right.
He's rolling them out based on teacher acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
And what's really interesting is he's actually had some schools that aren't fully digital yet. And so what's happening is the classroom don't have digital in it. The parents are putting a lot of pressures on the teachers,
mm-hmm.
saying, why don't you have digital? My students excelling in all the classes in the digital technology. They're in your class. We don't know why.
Mm-hmm.
And so peer pressure is really transforming the way the teachers do their lecturing and their schoolwork.
In the old PC time, where the access kids had to computers was primarily the lab, you know, go to a fixed computer and sit down. And it was always puzzling to me is the libraries at the high schools all closed at 3 o'clock. And the reason they closed at 3 o'clock was because the contract with librarians is that they could work at 3 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
And so the hour of homework, the hour of access to kids who have changed that now.
Mm-hmm.
It was just illustration of the contract, I thought, just not reflecting what the realities of how you need to succeed in school.
Mm-hmm. It might be helpful. See, I've sat and I've watched, you know, these 2 days, and you know, and Steve, you and I have talked before, but it might be helpful to just explain some of the features of this new approach and where broadband fits in.
So each of the students at the beginning of the year, they're a tablet device. So
mm-hmm.
it's not that they check it back in at the end of the school day. It's with them for the entire year. So the last day of school, they turn it back in again. So the important part about it is there are no more books. All the books are on the device. So it makes it very easy to assess them. And from the kid's standpoint, it's fun. Yeah, it's enticing. They embrace it. And like the mayor had said, is, you know, out at library hour after 3, they're in the car, they're on a football field, they're somewhere else, but they're able to take it with them. They're able to make productive use out of it. They're able to do their homework at any time of the day and evening.
In this after school class I went to, that they, I guess when you get a correct answer, you get a certain, a positive mention or so
mm-hmm.
forth, and they knew exactly how many. One kid said, "I have 3,685." Another girl said she had 3,115. I mean, they knew exactly, and there was just, it was an internal composition, but they also obviously knew where their colleagues or their
mm-hmm.
classmates were. And another way of using competition by getting a good mark to accelerate learning.
Mm-hmm.
But the important part is the parent at home now has access to a dashboard.
Uh-huh.
And this digital dashboard tells them, did they show up at school today, turned in all their homework assignments, and by the way, their average GPA at any given time. So now the parent can help manage the child in case there's any issues or problems or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. In some respects, is this not really taking advantage of Facebook and social media, like the ability to have what would be a like? I mean, if you have a Facebook page, you get so many likes, and if you're a student, you know, or of the teenage, you know, age bracket, you know, you probably have 2,000 friends and 50,000 likes. You have basically taken that same concept and then applied it to, you know, bonuses or likes for doing well in school.
Yeah.
Which in some places is not a cool thing to do. I mean, that's part of the struggle of education, is that in some teenage circles, being a good student is not popular.
Right.
So have you made it now popular?
I think we have.
That's just really, well, part of the question of popularity is how visible it is.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's between you and the teacher, you don't have to tell the person you walk to school with.
That's true. It's personal.
Right, mm-hmm. That's good. Now, so where does this go then? From you've number one, when did this start? Because the program.
This was in the last year and a half, right?
Yeah, 3 years ago they actually started middle schools getting them all netbooks, and they've contracted to Smart Riverside that rolls out digital inclusion to low-income families to actually provide their broadband support. And so since that period of time, because of our relationship mayor with Smart Riverside, they've been getting grants, and these grants have been able to fund over 12,500 devices for the schools.
Hmm.
Yep. Part of our digital inclusion, say you have 80,000 households in Riverside, to have 5,000 of those receive computers with training is really quite remarkable.
Hmm. So where do you go though next? I mean, so we've got the baseline established. We got a program in motion. What will we see, or what do you expect to see in a year or two?
Well, I think the big thing, I don't think there's turning back, the education thing will be the test scores.
Mm-hmm.
And if the test scores increase even modestly, I think you declare it a success. If the test scores don't change, you have control groups and they don't see any difference, then you got to ask, else do we need? What else is going on? What else do we need to do? But I was just reflecting, we know when television first came out, I think people saw it as a great educational tool to be introducing you. Well, that clearly did not work. I saw, I saw one major study they did of the test scores in television, and no matter how much or how little you watch television, there was a direct relationship. The more you watch television, the lower your test scores by sex, by socioeconomic status, by ethnicity, by urban, suburban. There was every major category you looked at, watching television decreased your test score. And I think one of the questions now is this process certainly seems that it will increase the test scores.
And that is the struggle, you know. But also, does it move us beyond just the test scores? Because one of the criticisms about, you know, No Child Left Behind and a number of these things is it gets everybody geared to taking a test and passing a test and how they rank in the test. But if you have now removed the walls to education, you can still focus on the test, but aren't you getting kids to and parents to move beyond the test?
Yeah.
Completion counts.
Yeah. One of the difficulties is people judge schools and where they're going to live by what the test scores are. For our city, we are competing for middle-class parents, and so test scores become important. But as Steve Reniker pointed out, we had this other major effort going on, which you call completion counts. It's a Gates grant. Four cities are involved, New York, San Francisco, Mesa, Riverside. The objective is to increase post-secondary education. The problem, particularly for Riverside students, was having them complete it, not simply start some kind of post-secondary work, actually complete it. And
meaning going to
college.
Right,
but
okay.
Once you start
but
college,
finishing. Right, right, right.
Or community college, or even a major post-secondary credential. Too many began, and too few, well, not enough began, but of those who began, too few. And we're trying to, we've set goals for ourselves, and we're, one example in Riverside, which I think we're going to become a model for the state of California, is that for high school students, if they get a certain kind of scores, they can sign a contract with the community college in our two city districts. We'll guarantee them access to courses and be able to finish in 2 years, which is, at least in California, a big deal.
Yes, it is. Now, will the technology play a role in completion counts, or is it just more that, you know, it'll have its effect on the overall education process? We'll hopefully get them smarter getting through high school.
They're using partly technology to give information. I mean, they have a 311 effort in which they're kind of loading. I have gone on.
Yeah.
So you tell them, what does it look like?
So it looks great. So it gives students to find out what opportunities exist out there, how you qualify for the program, and how to get into these programs.
Okay.
And so individuals, for example, we have in Smart Ed, we have some individuals there that came in through gang intervention programs, worked to get their GED. We trained them A+ certification. But in order for them to stay in our Smart Riverside program, we require that they stay enrolled into college. So they've used this College 311. They found out, how can I qualify to get in these courses? What is it going to take? And so information that in the past was very difficult to get access to, because I might have had gone down to the school, might have had to set up a time with a counselor to try to explain it to them. Now we've got these portals up there, as the mayor alluded to, this College 311 system, that they're able to answer all those questions for them online.
If your parents have gone to school, it's no big deal. But for many of our students now, their parents have not gone on to college. Many of them are the first time.
They're generation.
So they don't have the kind of context of a parent how to do all this. I mean, when I went to college, both my mother and father went to college. It's something I expect to do, and it's the information there. But the new technology is being used to help provide information to students and parents. We call this completion counts. We're trying to, I mean, what we're doing is obviously models that other cities and other districts will likely follow.
Mm-hmm. Let's actually talk about this for a second. How do you create some sort of template, for lack of a better word, to continue this kind of innovation in other communities? Because we've had, you know, the various mayors have come in today and talked about their many programs, you know, all good. You're the first one to talk about a, you know, being a model in terms of this program for the rest of the state. How do you create a model that works? I don't know if you guys.
Well, that's one of the things that the Gates Grants want to do is to have this not simply the money ran out, they have the program in, but so this is a combination, again, of a city, of the Chamber of Commerce, of the community college, and the two school districts. But the community college has worked out a program, so when after 3 years, it's $3 million grant a year. After money's ended, program will continue,
mm-hmm.
And I think if you accept the general judgment that it is talent that makes the world go around now, and it's what talent dividend is, what cities are looking at. Cities are going to be asking the question: how do we? Not Austin, Texas, which they have 70% of their number have college degrees.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's pretty high.
Right.
But I think as other cities aspire to increase that number, you're going to be looking around for successful strategies, successful models.
Mm-hmm. So you're packaging up your successful models?
Yes. Ready to go on the road. No, well, it's one of the, in part of what you do in this business, elected office, you look for best practices.
Mm-hmm.
And so I it's not thing, but you look, you just kind of scan around and you listen and say, aha, and you come back and tell Steve, I heard about this again, what do you think? And so you,
mm-hmm.
much, if I think Riverside, any number of kind of best practices, be asked where they came from, about
mm-hmm.
many of them
right.
came from visiting other places. You say, aha, that looks good, exactly the same.
Mm-hmm.
But the world's a laboratory, and you need to see. I mean, you don't have to, you know, create a case study for yourself. You can see how
others have created a case study.
Right. Right. So you have a larger end mm-hmm. that you're looking at.
I think a very positive aspect, and to me, it has been one of the things that sets apart the government sector from industry, because industry people, you know, will not talk to each other. I mean, they will fire you for talking about, you know, how they did what they did to other companies who may or may not be competitors. In the government space, it's just the opposite. Folks collaborate.
Yeah, we just sent out to every mayor and city manager in California our booklets of the 25 businesses.
Mm-hmm.
Here's what we best things we do. See if you might be interested in these.
That's it. Now, is that just for the technology or for just the city management overall?
Including several
technology and innovation.
It was the city overall.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. Now, I know some folks have heard about the digital program that you guys have done. And, in fact, I explained the relationship with you and the e-waste company for the mayor of St. John, who led off our day. But just give us a little bit more detail of how that program works, because it's a pretty good soup to nuts kind of a...
Yeah, well, let me just give my way of preference. A lot of people talk about digital, and they want to encourage greater access and greater availability and greater use, but it tends to be rather than operation. And so what we have, and Steve has been the in many ways the genius, is we've created a program, one where it's real.
How many 5,500
and there is not, you know, given out, there is pain and
right.
support for it,
mm-hmm.
and then there's some free Wi-Fi for them to use. that's sort of matching your rhetoric or your language and operationalizing it and producing a program that has real results.
Mm-hmm.
But, Steve, how do we do it?
Well, a lot of sweat and tears, that's for sure. But,
no doubt.
The key behind it was a gang intervention program between the county and the city called Project Bridge.
Mm-hmm.
We're able to get these youth that have aptitude skills for technology, and as I mentioned earlier, we teach them A+ certification. They learn how to refurbish PCs. We also have taught them how to sort e-waste. So we are not just a collector of e-waste; we mine e-waste. We actually separate the plastics, the metals, the copper, and the components on the inside to maximize revenue. And that's how we self-sustain the program. So that means through part of their schools, our schools actually provides the training, and the reason they provide the training at no cost to our city residents is because Smart Riverside has donated refurbished computers to labs for our schools. So during the day, the schools have refurbished PCs that they use, and then at nighttime, the certified instructors can teach class. And then our Smart Riverside team makes sure that when families graduate from the class, they're given this refurbished computer that's got Microsoft Office software on it, because when you're a nonprofit, you qualify to become a Microsoft authorized refurbisher, meaning you get the licenses as low as $6 each. And then we also provide a wireless access device so they have access to our free Wi-Fi with up to 1 meg.
Mm-hmm.
That works very well for them.
Would this program work, Steve, if you didn't have free Wi-Fi?
It wouldn't work as well. Certainly, a lot of communities out there struggle because they don't have free broadband options,
mm-hmm.
and you got to try to find a low broadband solution. But I think because of the economic conditions of our city, anybody that qualifies for a program has to make $45,000 or less. And a lot of those families had a lot of struggles this year, and being able to give them something at no cost was huge for them.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, and it was always referred to computers or at least access to something as a great equalizer. That
mm-hmm.
If you don't have that, you really are set back. You're set back because you don't have information. And so what this has done is it's a major help to people who otherwise wouldn't have access to information.
Mm-hmm. This is definitely, a strong effort. In many respects, what's the next step? I mean, in general, innovation has been an ongoing theme of conference, but and so I'm asking everybody, what's down the road there as far as innovation?
Your first answer to that, Steve.
The first thing is commercialization.
That's right. I did want to talk about that.
Close partnership with our university.
Mm-hmm.
The city has collaborated with the private sector to initiate and incubate new companies inside our city. And I think that's new. We've got the Innovation Economy Hub, which is around a 240-acre zone inside the city that has basically defined itself as all the companies necessary to commercialize a product,
mm-hmm.
whether it's molding company, whether it's a manufacturing facility, whether it's a service organization, we've got the wherewithal to incubate these entrepreneurs and startup companies in a local site.
One idea that I came away with this morning, and I'm still having to Steve has to be a check on it, but we have a lot of general plan stuff. We have a lot of elements to general plan. And, somehow to have a digital plan for the city, not simply city operation, but across the community, I think is something that we ought to consider. And so I want to try to raise this when I go back to
mm-hmm.
Riverside, is that you have an air quality element and you have you have a transportation element and you have housing elements. You have like 12 different elements. I think one of the elements needs to be a kind of digital element. If we're going to be a successful and distinctive city in the future, let's do this well. So anyway, that's. Mm-hmm. Take it back, put it on the agenda, and see where...
Then there you go. And that's basically how a lot gets done as far as, you know, mining these ideas. I assume, you know, it is coming back and having folks who are willing to pick up the charge. Now, one thing I want to ask about, because it seems like this is sort of a, I guess what I would call sort of an undercurrent. In when I go to Chattanooga, I've been down to Riverside, there seems to be a feeling among government workers and staff and executives and elected officials almost across the board, there is a very positive spirit toward innovation and new ideas, right? Because you have on the stage lots of criticism, lots of bashing of government workers. But what I find to be the case in communities such as yours is a spirit among the government sector, the local government sector. Is that true, number one? And my observation is correct, but more importantly, how do you get that? Because I think there are a lot of communities, a lot of cities that would love to have that kind of spirit among its government workforce.
Well, one of the things of local government, we're not quite convulsed by the kind of partisanship and great divide you find in the state and federal level. And much of what takes place at local level is much more pragmatic than it is ideological, because you have certain outcomes you're looking for, and you sort of share those. You want a safe city, you want a good education, you want good health care, good neighborhoods. Those are not ideological. Ideological issues. The other, I think, the assets that Riverside has, and many cities have it, is you look around and ask, what are your major assets?
Mm-hmm.
We concluded they are your universities. Their trademark really is innovation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we are helped in Riverside by having, you know, 60,000 students taking coursework and the role that the universities play.
Mm-hmm. Last question, I'll let you guys go. Are you specifically, as part of your overall plan, harnessing those students or the general creativity and innovation of the student body? Do you have some mechanism for tapping into that to help either plan or execute your various projects?
The answer is yes. You know, and kind of it goes twofold. I mean, one of the things the mayor has done is the mayor is an expert at collaboration.
Mm-hmm.
We have more groups together that communicate with all levels of business. He's got task force with our higher and K-12s. He's got groups such as our CEO forum where we have CEOs of high-tech companies in Riverside that collaborate and provide feedback to the mayor through Smart Riverside. So our nonprofit, Smart Riverside, it's chaired by our mayor. I happen to be the director that executes on it. And so these students out there that are in Riverside, all because of that level of collaboration, are using the technology in their schools.
Mm-hmm.
They're going on to higher education. And those at our university, California Riverside, now have these great ideas. And we've got companies through the private sector that are taking them and incubating their thoughts and ideas. And we've got groups of people to help determine how to create business plans, how to patent a thought or an idea, and how to commercialize your product. So the whole goal there is the mayor has created an environment where these students now will have jobs locally, and they're going to want to stay in Riverside.
Okay. I guess the number of it, unless you connect with young people, you're not connecting with the technology future. So
that makes sense. Well, again, Mr. Mayor, thank you very much for being our guest today.
Thank you.
Steve, thanks for coming back one more time. And I will definitely stay in touch with Riverside and all the stuff that's going on there. So, gentlemen, come on around. We're ready to top off our show. It's been a really great information exchange here, for which I am very pleased and very grateful for all of these mayors that have given up a little bit of their time and stepping out of the conference to kind of give you, the listener, an idea of what's been happening here at the ICF event. I want to now conclude our show with our last guests, who are from Quebec. So we're going back north of the border one more time here. I took German in high school, but I'm going to try not to abuse your name. But it's Regis Labome.
Labome.
Okay. This is why I don't speak internationally. Anyway, I'm sorry. But
and
welcome.
Come on, we do it in French.
So he's talking to the
Ah, ich heiße Craig. Wie geht? Ah, and welcome both of you for spending time with us and giving us some more thoughts and insights on innovation. So let's talk about what's going on in Quebec. This is your, I guess, first time at the ICF in top seven.
Yeah.
So that means you're doing some kind of great innovation. Let's have it here. What are you guys doing?
We have some problem. I would say that the first problem we have is that our unemployment rate is too low.
Uh-huh.
I don't want to be arrogant, but we need some more people. resources, because we went through the recession with no impact at all. So
wow. Send your place, folks. There's a place for you. You know, dust off the high school French and just let's just go.
No problem. You can, you're German or English, no problem. Take everybody and you're going to have fun.
That's good. That's good.
I guarantee.
Just on the innovation front, a few things as we were presenting and part of the package that we put forward. A few things, the diversification of the economy, focusing on a few sectors where we think that we can compete locally and internationally. So that's one of those. Secondly, in terms of some ideas of innovation, we put together some, because one of the discussions this afternoon was on open innovation. We've been doing a lot of things or a lot of bets around open innovation with local SMEs and big companies that are facing some problems. And actually, we created an event that's called Quebec Seek Solution, where companies can submit their problem, and during the course of a day or 2 days, local researchers were going to try to resolve the problems that the companies or the SMEs are facing. And
wow.
We were successful in finding solution to the problems of those companies.
So let's... Now, is this directly related to your broadband advance, or is this just
no,
part of the picture?
No, that's separately, because on the broadband front, we've been receiving a lot of funding. A lot of companies actually have been putting some what we call to the home.
Mm-hmm.
So Quebec City was picked by one of the biggest carriers in the country, which is called Bell Canada, and they're investing close to $250 million in Quebec City, and that's the first city in where they're going to be putting as much effort, and it's going to be the biggest in terms of the number of homes that are going to be connected to the system.
Now, that's more of a residential, or is it going to affect businesses as well?
Residential and business as well.
Mm-hmm.
The objective is to hook up all of the houses to the next 2 years.
Now, one of the things that actually got my attention, because this is a big issue here in the U.S., is the level of support that you can get from the private sector. Because we, if you follow a lot of what's going on, and we have a certain amount of friction between local governments trying to get more broadband, faster mm-hmm. broadband, higher quality broadband, and a private sector that's a little different sometimes, depending on size of the city. But similar to Tai Chong, who's our guest a little earlier this afternoon, and what I've read about you guys is that you're getting fairly aggressive support from the private sector.
Mm-hmm.
How'd you do that?
It's because of the mayor. He's our top seller. He's our number one personality, and he's the one that convinced everyone to look at
Quebec. If they want to do business in Quebec City, they have to give something. So,
yes, okay.
It's a give and take, but I think because of the economic situation of the region, that low unemployment rate, business is thriving and it's growing. People see that there is some opportunity for business, for the private sector to come and invest, because as any private companies, they're looking for return on investment.
Mm-hmm.
And based on what we're getting and seeing from those companies, they're saying that the investment was made or, you know, was valuable, and they actually are making money out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because people are converting, people are increasing shares and things like that, and they're getting the dollars in terms of, and the number of clients getting on the system.
Mm-hmm.
You see, we're quite a small city also, so we know each other, public and private sectors. So when we have a project, we just take the telephone and we call everybody, so everybody has to put some money, and then it works. And they know that the city will always be there anyway. So we put the first amount of money and they would follow. But anyway, it's going well and everybody is happy and everybody knows that, you know, they will profit from that. So it's a team effort.
Mm-hmm. And I think at the same time for the companies, it's a good marketing, you know, as well, because, you know, they're capable to show to the rest of the world and to the rest of the country that they're able to do an entire community in an amount and a period of time that's quite fast. And it's, you know, the level of investment suffices to me.
Mm-hmm. Now, the economic dynamic, which seems to work against us in the U.S., is, you know, the big telephone companies have formulas by which they make their investments, right? They have to see X number of customers at X number of dollars per person and or per house or whatever. And in poor neighborhoods, in urban areas, as well as small rural areas, which it may not even be poor. I mean, it's maybe just not a lot of people per square mile. Those become barriers because they don't fit that formula, right? And so, and we can't, like, you almost have to use dynamite to get the people to move because they won't go past their formula. How do they not work the same way in Quebec, or does this just, by their private sector?
I've never heard about that because, now, I know they're coming in Quebec City, but because the economy is strong, but I've never heard about that.
No.
It's quite sad that I hear, you know, you have to develop your future clients. And so it means that you're poor, you're going to be poor. Huh?
It is the way, unless you can find a way to bring customers to the table. Now, what some smaller communities have done in the U.S., I mean, like 5,000-6,000 people.
They purchased this.
Well, they will work with a smaller provider, number one, because they don't usually have the same layers of bureaucracy to support or stockholders. And then they will bring their customer, their citizens together to really identify needs that those citizens are willing to pay for. So what they're able to say is, yes, we may only have 4,000 people, but they want to buy this service, and that service. And can you provide it and still be profitable because we got numbers.
Yes. What I saw in some of the smaller community in some places, they actually created like co-ops.
Mm-hmm. So co-ops have become popular.
So, which is a way for them to be able to get a provider one, and at the same time, they're actually creating jobs in their community because it's the people of the community that actually are, you know, are members of the co-op to get a job. So that's what I've seen. But from our perspective, no, we've not been facing the same type of situation.
Well, count your blessings, because it sounds like you have plenty of, plenty of people working and cooperative broadband stuff going on. Okay, so what kinds of innovations are happening out of there in terms of, you know, what's broadband driving in your communities?
Well, the first thing is, you know, the diversification of the economy, because you want to attract, retain your companies that are in the creative sector, that are in some of the key sector or the knowledge-based sector. They need access to technology, and they need access to broadband and fast access. So that's an element that we're using to keep and to attract and to help our local companies to continue to grow locally instead of having to look at other places to get access to the type of broadband infrastructure that they would need. So that's the first thing. The second element that we're also looking at it from a broadband is how can we use it as a feature to attract and continue to attract people and even people at the university level.
Mm-hmm.
That's another example with whatever university, Laval University actually was one of the last ones to have open access Wi-Fi in their university,
mm-hmm.
but now they're at the far because of the speed, because of the other things. So, you know, they move in front of the parade, in front of their competition,
mm-hmm.
and now they can actually use it to track and also to retain some of their teachers, some of the students that are looking at new technology and broadband infrastructure and Wi-Fi as part of the means to educate and also to transform the economy.
Mm-hmm.
So those are two examples.
That's interesting. I have seen lots of cases of, you know, industries moving out.
Yeah.
And then it's like, well, what do we do now? Because they were single industry dependent.
Yeah.
It sounds like what you're trying to create is a multi-industry environment, so
yeah.
that you're no longer vulnerable
yeah.
to that kind of
yeah.
Because we were, right? We were, our economy used to be based on the on power and government, you know, so...
Mm-hmm.
When, you know, that trend where governments decided to cut their, so they cut their people, their employees, and we had big impacts in Quebec City. This is where, why we just decided to see how can we diversify our local economy. So, but we've been lucky. We went through it and we succeeded.
Yeah. Just going back on the broadband, to give you another example, the city is going to be opening a new industrial park. We're actually working with some of the suppliers like Bell to make sure that the broadband infrastructure is at the corner of the park when we're going to be opening it, when the city is going to be opening again in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
So that if we attract a company, they're not going to wait 6 months to a year to get access to the broadband.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, the planning, it's the process, and working with the partners and the suppliers to be ready when the companies arrive.
Mm-hmm. So how does a mayor all of those different moving parts together and same page?
Well, I would say that we all share the same vision. Okay, we know where we want to go, and you know, I always say that you have 25 leaders in the city of like Quebec City, and we all share the same vision. And on the tech side, this is the same thing. We know where we're going, and we all agree. Usually, we all agree on the same project.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's easy to join the mayor also, so Cal could speak to me anytime. And we have the same target, and we all have the same issue.
But don't you have different goals and objectives? I mean, if you've got private sector, you got education, you got healthcare, and heaven knows how many divisions within each of those segments. Doesn't the single vision become one of like finding a way to get past everyone's self-interest? I mean, how do you do that part? Because that's
we're all making money. Everybody's happy. The economy is going well. So, and you know, if somebody would say no, we will remember that. Let me be frank. I was like that. I mean, I'm always there.
There you have it, folks.
No, I'm always there. So if they say no, I will remember.
Yeah, back in 2008 when we were trying to
remember
that.
Oh, so you're asking me to do that? Be fine. I was 9.
You didn't share your ice cream.
I'm telling you, remember from the Sandlot, man, back in the day.
But it doesn't happen.
That is good. That's very good. What was biggest challenge? I mean, I see how you have persuaded. Okay, kudos on that.
Challenge
what's
to get
the
people.
Challenge?
To get people. This is our main problem. We need to get people. We don't have enough people. Now, putting a lot of energy, Cal in his organization to promote immigration. This is the big target now.
Mm-hmm.
The big issue.
Our biggest challenge is actually the talent. It's attracting people.
Mm-hmm.
We know that over the next 5 years, we're going to be facing probably around 70,000 jobs that we'll have to fill.
Wow.
Some of them through people that are going to retire and people that are actually as well the growth of the economy.
Yeah. And so go ahead.
So basically, so
can we do? So one of the things we decided to do was to focus on going abroad, trying to people to let them know about Quebec City, what we have to offer, and trying to convince people from around the world that it would be the place for them to grow and bring their family and making it their new home.
Mm-hmm. Now, by the way, Quebec International, was that the Economic Development Planning Group?
For the Economic Development Agency for
agency.
The region.
Yeah. Okay. Is your organization then the, I'll call it, for lack of a better word, the lead planner, like someone who kind of makes sure all the plans come together?
Well, we're a non-for-profit organization, mm-hmm. and the objective that we follow with our partners, the city is one of our major partners. We work with them, we develop their plan, and actually we're evaluated based on delivering a plan. So I get part of my funding. If I don't deliver what I'm supposed to do, I'm not going to get funded,
mm-hmm.
or I'll get cut on my funding. So the objective is to deliver what their partners are asking
mm-hmm.
us to do, and we've been delivering what they ask us to do.
Just to give you an example, so a few months ago, we issued my own economic development plan. So we just write it down with Quebec International.
Mm-hmm.
And to fit what they're doing. And another couple of organizations, so that we would work. So Cal has been active to build it, even to write it.
Mm-hmm.
So we like that.
And the objective is over 5 years that he's going to be committing $45 million to support the economic plan.
Mm-hmm. If you were in an opposite situation where you didn't have how do I describe it? Where the economics were a little bit different. I mean, you are sort of in a unique position relative to a lot of folks because you have more work than there are people to do those jobs. If you were in an opposite situation, do you think you would be able to use broadband to get to where you are now?
Sure. Yes.
And then how would you see that working if you had to resuscitate it versus
I call that an infrastructure. That's it.
Yeah, I would use the infrastructure as an asset to attract, and as I said, retain. But it mainly to attract, because you know, broadband and everything that has to do with it is part of the new economy. It's one of those pillars of the economy. You need it. You need people. You need ideas. You need innovation, and you need a culture that is coming from the private, the public, and the academics or the universities.
Mm-hmm.
So we need a combination of all of this working together and driving the economy of a region.
It reminds me what Premier McKenna did in the province of New Brunswick in Canada. He was the first one to invest in government, and he had this very good impact on his economy.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that the person from Australia is and discussing with
people. Right. Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be interesting to see, because they said that they were going to do it for the entire country,
mm-hmm.
and to see what it did in terms of, you know, from an economic point of view and how it propelled Australia down the road. So it's going to be interesting to hear about.
Right. Now, this is, I don't know if this is an issue or not, but you have had a divide of sort over the language. It's not there a, you know, the whole French...
It was a challenge, I would say, but not that much now, because the youth is bilingual. So, and maybe, you know, my daughter, she was trilingual at 19. So, you know, time changing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Has the technology helped? I know youth helps getting past those barriers.
Yeah, I think there's a few things. You know, we're in a more global economy. People have, you know, the younger generation has probably a more open to what's going on around the world.
Mm-hmm.
The objective that we're pursuing is, you know, that we have a French culture. We're a combination of the best of two worlds of Europe and North America by providing this environment where people can live, can work in an environment. They can work in English and live in a French community or vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for us, when we're on, you know, a place like New York, it's Europe without the jet lag.
We're close to perfect. Finally.
Yeah, geez, there you go. But let's talk about that for a second. Is, you know, can the technology, you know, its openness, its way that you open up the gates of new, can it be used to really mediate a lot of internal stress that is counterproductive. I mean, you know, 20 years ago, like, you know, at least as we were reading the news, in the it seemed like a really serious thing. You know, I look at kids, you know, the average teenager who is on three devices talking to 15 people, multitasking for forever, to which language is like a...
It's not as much as it was. You know, I'm this is my own personal view looking at my kids. They don't see things the same way that we did maybe 20 years ago. So, as I say, they're probably more part of a global... They do understand that they have to keep their French heritage, but in a way that it could be used as an advantage, because at least, you know, they speak two languages, and as Mr. Mayor was saying, the vast majority of the kids that are around are 20. Now, in Quebec, a lot of them are speak three languages. So, you know, it's an added value, as it is perceived in many places, like in Europe, the more language you speak, it is added value, and you can use it in different ways and means.
Excellent. The... Let's talk about Gigabit. I have, in a number of places, listened to folks, to the enlightened folks, talk about the need to bring kids into the learning process. I mean, there was a guy who, in the state of Missouri, right, there was a summit, they're talking about statewide broadband. You know, what are the innovations we're going to get? How are we going to drive adoption? How are we going to change the community? And this guy, who was, I guess, in his late 50s, early 60s, in no uncertain terms, said he brings teenagers into meetings, and he tells his people that, you know, that work for him, you know, we are going to listen to what they have to say, and we're going to take cues from what they have to say, which to me, you know, it's a great step, because older folks, older administrators particularly, you know, aren't necessarily that open to new stuff in general, to where he's saying we're going to turn over a chunk of our planning to kids.
Well, from the perspective that Mr. Labombe has always put forward, is that the way forward is what can we do to attract and retain the younger generation. Our objective is to be a city, a place where these people can find a place to live, a place to work, but also a place to grow. And if you look at the statistics, you know, work is probably now down as the third element that they're going to look. They're first going to be looking at quality of life and you know, a great place to live, and afterwards they're going to look at their job. So the younger generation has a new way of looking at things. Their values are probably not in the same orders that, you know, were like some of us, that the first thing was to get a job and work was number one, and then the rest would come out. I think that the younger generation is looking at it differently. So the and his way of looking for it is, what can we do to ensure that these people are going to come and live? And, you know, we're in the polytechnic today. What can we do to get those kids that are coming out of those engineering schools that they will stay and grow in the community?
You know, when I've been elected, I would say to our civil servants, you know, we're not going to be in the city and in tune with our value. I mean, people like me, that is 50-something and 60-something. I mean, we're going to build the city with the new values, and we know those values. You know, you could see a lot of documents about that. So I always say, when we take a big decision, do you think it's going to help us to attract kids? Okay, this is our main problem, and this is our challenge, And you know, as I said, what are the new values of the kids? First of all, a nice place, a good environment to raise a family. Secondly, a nice place to live for themselves. And a good place to have a good professional life and, you know, to make a good pay. So it's probably the other way around about what I had as values when I was 20-something. So now, and you know, I take this example. Let's say there is a couple that, you know, studied at the Montreal Polytechnic. They have one kid, they're between 25 and 30. Those guys would be able to work anywhere in the world because you know, they have good diplomas, they're bilingual, trilingual. Can those people decide to come to live in Quebec City? And what can I do to try to attract them?
Mm-hmm.
So when we invest big amount of money from the taxpayer, we're just asking ourselves, you think it's going to help to bring them in Quebec City?
Mm-hmm.
So very different, eh?
Yeah.
Because, you know, our the bureaucracy, we have a bureaucracy of 5,000 people. You know, they're not, the average age is probably 50-something, eh?
Mm-hmm.
So they would think that the city, the future of the city, which should look like that. You know, but they design the future of the city, they're planning the city with their own values, which is big mistake.
Ah, right.
And you have to be rough to try to, you know, control that, because they're not the future of the city. Mm-hmm. And I'm not the future of the city. I'm 56. I'm not the future of this city.
Mm. Interesting. Very interesting. I find this interesting because it's not only just a vision at this point. At a certain point, it comes down to a certain sense of, like, will our professional, will our ego get in the way of a logical conclusion?
Mm.
You know, because I can sit here and say, yes, you know, the future is not us old people, you know, but then I tend to be radical and off the chain quite a bit. And so, but I think at a government level, you know, government workers, well, workers in general, management in general, I think that is older, is more resistant to change. And
yep.
There's a certain amount of ego invested in them, right?
Human being.
And you've got to be able to address that, I think. Which
my ego would feel very good if I bring kids in Quebec City. That would be good for my ego.
A good legacy. Interesting. Well, gentlemen, I am more than pleased that you have spent
Thank you. Shared
some new light. I may call again. You know, I may definitely call again, have you on the show in another 6 months or a year to see what, you know, what's
Anytime.
New. And one of these days, you know, I need to.
Why don't you come?
There. I've been to Toronto. I've been to Vancouver. I have yet to make it to Quebec, and I obviously have to do that.
Nicest city in the country.
Not a problem.
Thank you, sir.
Again,
waiting for you, eh?
No worries, mate.
Thank you.
All right, have a great day.
Thank you, sir.
All righty. All right, folks, thank you very much, all of our listeners, for checking in today.
Very good question, by the way.
Ah, thank you, yeah. Thank you. We have said adieu to our friends from Quebec. This has been, I'm just awed at it all. And so I hope that, that everyone here has enjoyed, the interviews today, that people tell your friends, your colleagues working on broadband projects, you know, 3 hours that we've spent here today covered a lot of mileage, a lot of innovation, a lot of new ideas and so forth and so on. That's what Gigabit Nation is all about, is bringing new ideas to the table, helping people get broadband where it needs to be. I want to thank you, the audience. I want to thank Hiawatha Broadband Communications, one of our sponsors. It has been a great day, a good conference, and I hope to see you or hear you or you hear me in the upcoming. Thank you and good day.